This is The Think Tank, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. With Dr. Mike O'Neill and hosted by Mike Russell. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Mike Russell is out this week. Mike O'Neill here, mano a mano with Chuck Coughlin, Republican consultant. Tell us how you got into this business and who you worked for.
Well, first, good to see you, Mike. Thanks for having me on the program. I will say I was in college. I did a number of internships in Washington, D.C., and one of those led me to the firm of Smith and Haroff at the time. And Mark Haroff was then a Denison grad, as I was, and his partner, Jay Smith, was the consultant for John McCain. Mm-hmm. And I was working on a congressional race in Ohio.
Around when is that?
This is 1984, Reagan's second midterm Reagan.
Morning in America.
Yeah. And he was working on a congressional race in Ohio 19, and we had Senator, then Congressman John McCain, come and visit and campaign for the candidate I was working for, a guy by the name of Matt Hatchadorian.
I remember just a side. It was around that time. I ran into Congressman John McCain on the street.
There you go.
And he invited me into a staff meeting. I thought that was interesting.
Well, and that was sort of my thing. And we got John to come out. I got to take him around Cleveland at the time. And I was, you know, hey, he was American war hero, the crown prince, young guy, expansive view of the Republican Party. And was really pleased to meet him. And at that point in time, I knew he was going to be running, or the rumor was that that Barry Goldwater was going to be retiring, and he was going to be running for the U.S. Senate seat against then Governor Bruce Babbitt, which was going to be one of the classic matchups in that cycle. And I talked my way onto the campaign and came out and did fundraising for before I knew that Governor Babbitt then decided not to run.
Well, I'll tell you an interesting story about the intersection of all those folks. I was introduced to John McCain. I had done election work at KTAR 1980. An interesting election in which Barry Goldwater only won his final reelection when they counted the absentee votes.
Yeah.
And the executive producer said, there's a guy I want you to meet. He's an ex-POW, and I think he's going to have a future in Arizona politics, and I want you to meet him. And he bought me lunch at the then Plaza Club.
Yeah.
And the question of the hour was, should I run against Senator Dennis DeConcini or Governor Bruce Babbitt?
Mm-hmm.
And I often wondered whether I suspect I wasn't the only person giving this advice. He took the advice, which was neither.
Right. He didn't do it.
My assessment is that they were both very formidable, and that was going to be a losing proposition.
Right. And he needed to put some roots down here, and he did that. And when then Congressman Rhodes retired, he ran for that seat out in Mesa as a congressman. And so
only competitive race he ever had was the primary for the first congressional
seat. First time.
And he
wore out a lot of shoe leather and shook a lot of hands and worked his tail off, which has become a hallmark of all his campaigns. And so I was blessed to work on that campaign in one respect. I thought I was doing fundraising at the time, which was going to be an easy job raising money because we're going to be running against Bruce Babbitt. And, well, of course, Babbitt drops out to run for president. And we ended up running against a guy by the name of Richard Kimball, literally the running man, and who was a corporation commissioner at the time. And my job became incredibly miserable because everybody's like, well, John's going to win. You don't need money. And so
I thought it was easier to raise money for somebody who's going to win anyway. That's usually where the money goes.
Well, at this point in time, that may have been the case today, but back then
it depends on whether it's a cause.
Money really hadn't gotten into politics as it is today, as much as it is. And so, I stayed, worked in Arizona, went to work for Bob Robb after that, or Mesa Chamber of Commerce, Bob Robb, when he had his shop. Bob really taught me how to run campaigns. First campaign I worked on him was, I think, Arizonans for Official English. We did the Martin Luther King campaign. We did John Kyle's congressional campaigns. We did campaigns for the Scottsdale Stadium. We did the Maricopa Road bond campaign. We did
This stuff's really bringing me back.
Yeah, I know. It was like really it was a blessing to work for him because Bob's a great thinker, and he really taught me how to run a business and then how to think about campaigns. And so After that, went to work for Grant Woods. When Grant was the attorney general, left Grant, went into private industry with waste management for about 3 years, was recruited back to run for Fife Symington's reelection campaign in 94, worked for Fife for a couple years, then left to start my own firm, eventually became his first Coughlin Communications and then High Ground.
I love the name, by the way, especially after its origin was explained to me.
Yeah, it was 1996. It was the era of, Killer Angels, the Civil War movie, and Ken Burns' documentaries on the Civil War. And I became a huge Civil War buff. And, you know, one of the rules in the Civil War was always to pick the ground that you're fighting on. It was one of Lee's greatest tactical advantages throughout the war, and which ended up defeating him when he lost the war and lost the Battle of Gettysburg, because it was just bad ground to fight on. So you become a strategic thinker about how you deploy yourself. And a lot of people thought at the time it had, of course, the double entendre of being morally superior.
You had me. I had that one wrong.
No, and that became the joke, that everybody goes, oh, you're morally superior. I'm like, no, it's much more of a schoolyard thing. Never pick a fight going uphill.
I want to move you into very contemporary Arizona politics. The governor seems to have pulled off a major coup on the education front, bringing together diverse interests and settling this longstanding education lawsuit.
I think he deserves credit. It seemed like the process had broken down between the litigation was actually between the House and the Senate and the education establishment, the community that's the school board association, the AEA, that sued on the inflation factor, and they had won. But the settlement wasn't moving, so he did bring the parties together. Used principally one of the ideas we discussed a lot during the campaign of bringing money forward from the state land trust that now has $6 billion earning 2.5% interest a year to offset a good portion of that commitment. And it's a 10-year deal and bring money forward from the state general fund. I think that he deserves credit for bringing that forward. I suspect it will pass with fairly substantial numbers in May. But it's not. It's the beginning of a discussion, I think, that is going to continue on through his administration, is how do we fund schools in Arizona, K through 12? This is the settlement of a lawsuit. So it's not a high bar aspirational thing. It's a low bar meet the letter of the law thing. And so what are we going to do to fund K through 12 going forward? We haven't funded capital commitments on K through 12 for years. That's been gone unaddressed. I hope we don't wait for a tragedy or some roof to collapse or an air conditioner to fall in on some kids in a classroom before we address that. And then the universities. Governor Brewer had established with the Board of Regents a plan to fund the universities moving forward. And that seemed to have been abandoned in the first budget that this governor and the legislature proposed, and there really isn't a formula for the universities to work with them going forward. And they took a $99 million cut last time. We've cut more from higher education than any other state in the country, there doesn't seem to be a path forward, at least an agreed upon path on how to address it.
I see one thing in terms of a path forward. This is an almost novel concept in recent American politics, compromise.
Yeah.
and that to me is a basis for a whole lot of further discussion, because at both the state and the national level, it's not what we've been doing. We are here with Chuck Coughlin, Republican consultant and political thinker, and we'll be back in just a minute in the Think Tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're here with Chuck Coughlin, Republican consultant, and we left the conversation on the word compromise.
Yeah, which was really because it goes back to, you know, one of my favorite historians is Shelby Foote, the Civil War historian. And he it's really funny in that Ken Burns series on the Civil War. He actually said, you know, it's funny. And this was back then, even in the 90s, that, you know, compromise, he says, in its Southern drawl, has just become a dirty word in American politics. But yet that was the essence of the founding of our country. And that one of the reasons that we have such an unbelievably successful successful country economically, politically, the opportunities that we have is because ideology, you know, practicality always trumped historically political ideology. I mean, from the very beginning of our country's history with, you know, Hamilton and Jefferson, the compromise on the federal bank, and today.
I mean, including crazy stuff like two senators from every state, which was to protect against dominance of small states by big states. I can't think of a single instance in our history where the big states have been aligned against the small states.
And so you're thinking now that we're talking about Senator McCain leading into this cycle.
Let's stick on this. I do want to get to that, but we're the topic of compromise in our politics, which you know, both sides. It's a dirty word. That's what I think was extraordinary about what the governor did in this instance was he basically, you know, either side could have on this case dug in their heels. The education people had sued. They were winning everything.
Mm-hmm.
The legislature was in a position to say, yeah, but make me. You know, you can't make me appropriate funds.
True.
And they sure as heck could have delayed it for years.
Well, and I think that's the role of governor. A governor is where literally the president, the governor, that's where the buck stops. Everybody else is an actor on the stage. But when people look to say, did something get done? And clearly the governor was looking at issues, getting a lot of pressure from the business community and others saying, hey, this has to be resolved in order to move forward on any type of education funding plan in the state. This has to be done. And the governor recognized that in his first year as a governor. He recognized, hey, I got to step up. He called during his State of the State speech. He called on the legislature to solve it. Well, they didn't. So he stepped up and filled that role. I was going to transition to the thought on McCain doing the same thing with attempting to do the same thing on immigration reform.
Mm-hmm.
He's held on to the bat, if you will, on the compromise legislation that he's worked up with Senator Flake on immigration reform.
Do you think we're going to see that reemerge?
I don't think we'll see it, but I don't see him in this cycle running away from that issue because I believe particularly a plurality of even Republican primary voters in Arizona who have been bathed in this issue time and time and time again, all the way back to 2010. We have a mature electorate in terms of understanding the rhetoric of politicians. And both he and Senator Flake have offered and gotten off the deck a significant proposal to reform our nation's immigration laws and to enhance border security. That has not been acted on the House. You haven't seen him walk away from this. We had a meeting, a whole group of us with the senator immediately following the last election cycle, and uniformly everybody in the room was supportive of him holding on to that, and he's going to hold on to that.
Marco Rubio was one of the people who signed on to that, right?
And now disappointing.
But I mean, he is taking a lot of heat for that right now in the Republican primary.
Which is sad to see him, and he has shifted on that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a tactical mistake on his part because, again, a majority of the Republican electorate sees it as a path forward. We have been a nation that has traditionally prospered, and our birth has been through the diversity of our economy, the trade, and open relationships with all kinds of global economies. Mm-hmm. And this is the foundational point of that, that people can come and go under a legal trade status that allows them to participate in the American economy, the American economic experience, export that American economic experience, particularly in Mexico, where, you know, it's Arizona's largest trading partner. It is it is in the state's best interest that we figure out a way to legalize trade and immigration between our state and the states in Mexico in order for our economy to fully develop. And he understands that. A majority of the Republican electorate understands that. And I don't think people are going to fall for the baiting that's been going on that, you know, Ted Cruz and others in the presidential cycle have been espousing.
Seems to be working so far.
Well, but it depends on the audience you're appealing to and who you're appealing to.
Republican primary
voters.
Well,
Republican primary voters, and we'll find out in Iowa and in New Hampshire. We'll find out. But I think there's somebody has to take the talking points of Ronald Reagan and say, you know, we have the economic torch of liberty here. This is something that is the foundational principle of America. And if we do not hold on to it, it will be the end of our American experiment.
Not just Ronald Reagan. Are you familiar with the essay that Gary Goldwater wrote in 1962?
I don't think so.
Okay. He basically, it's the 50th anniversary of statehood, and yep. he's writing about 50 years in the future. What would I like to see in Arizona in 2012?
Mm-hmm.
Way, way off in the distant future.
I remember something about that, yeah.
Open borders.
Yeah.
An open border with Mexico.
Well, at least an open in the sense of that it's a... that it's a regulated, understood commercial enterprise. That's aspirational. That should be yep. the way it is. And
no,
so
it's interesting. He even used the language that is now anathema. He said, "I want a completely open." You
know, so I think he'll hold on. He's going to hold on to that view, which is good for him. You know, I as I mentioned earlier, I began my political career in Arizona. I was proud to work with John McCain because he was a big tent Republican Party guy, and he's running that campaign again. Today.
Well, so real quick, when we'll get to this, you got a 30-second answer. Is John McCain going to have more trouble in the primary or the general?
I don't think he has a lot of trouble in either,
okay.
But probably the primary.
Okay. Fair answer. We will be back with Chuck Coughlin, Republican consultant. We will talk politics, Arizona, in the think tank.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we're back with Chuck Coughlin talking about politics, particularly Republican politics. John McCain is up for re-election. You think it's going to be an... I was actually surprised to say that you thought he would have more difficulty in the primary.
Well, so,
not much in either was part of the answer.
Yeah, I think that, you know, John has been a party guy his whole life. And as the party, as we've watched, both parties have moved away from problem solving into more ideology. And John, you know, military guy, practical leader. Point A to point B, do these things, get these things done. And so I think it's but a true party guy. And so, you know, when the Maricopa County Republican Party censures him, it hurts him, you know, I think it says more about them than about him.
That was just shocking.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, this is
it should
party,
be shocking to a lot of people.
60% of the state,
yeah.
Sitting senator who, if you look at his voting record,
yeah.
Well, he's voting Republican conservative 90% of the time or
and
something like
it
that.
It says a lot about where the party's going, but it does.
It kind of says to me, this is a group that's saying if you're not with us 100%,
right.
It's not good enough.
Right. And so what we've seen, as we know, is a decrease in participation in primary election participation. We've seen a polarization of the electorate and an increase. Last general election cycle, we had a 30-year low turnout. Well, what is that? If you're in a free market system, that says you're not talking to your audience. It says you're not speaking to the people out there and getting them to participate. And so I think John's been around the track. The senator's been around. He started, as I said earlier, as a big tent Republican thinker. I believe this will be his last election. He's going to hold on to that view of the Republican Party as a problem-solving party, and he will be that candidate that I knew in 1986 when I ran when I worked for him in that first Senate campaign. And so his opponents in this race are not well financed. They're very disorganized. They do represent, as we said, probably 25-30% of the Republican primary, hardcore electorate. But John's focusing on a turnout in this cycle that's a bigger election turnout with Republicans and speaking to the Republican base of the big Republican base about the importance of this election cycle. And let's face it, the biggest issues on the deck right now are foreign relations-based issues with what's happening with terrorism and ISIS.
Terrorism took a big bump. And that gets tied to immigration.
He's chairman of the Armed Services Committee. He has more experience in these matters than anybody else practically in Congress. And he's viewed as somebody who's a rational problem solver on these issues. That's a guy that I feel comfortable with in a more uncertain world. I feel comfortable knowing that John McCain is chairman of the Armed Services Committee and he's my senator from Arizona.
Guys of that profile at the moment are not doing very well right now in Republican primary. I don't want to get into the election too much, but just
it's early.
It is early. That profile isn't playing well at the moment.
Yeah, it's early, and I tend to believe that there's a lot of that is media driven for their own purposes of driving numbers well in advance of an election cycle
I think I might take out the intentionality. It is media driven. I saw an interesting figure when Donald Trump is leading the pack, and a simultaneous figure that 85% of the coverage of the election is about Donald Trump.
Right. So, I mean, we did a survey recently, a statewide survey out here in Arizona, and we asked Republican voters. Actually, it was a statewide, bipartisan, high efficacy voter survey. We asked them to rate the credibility of each of these candidates. We put Trump in the survey. Mm-hmm. He got out of one. 95% of the electorate gave him a one. I think we had zero on there, they would have given him a zero.
Low credibility, but he resonates with me, I think, a lot of voters.
I think he resonates with the media because he's like a reality TV show. He's a quote machine, you know, when he's running around just pouring out vitriol. You know, we're back to, you know, lionizing a period in American history when we were deporting people willy-nilly out of the country, which was not a proud moment in American history. And that's what he's saying he wants to go back to.
Yeah, Operation Wetback.
Yeah, there you go.
That tells you a little bit about what it was.
Yeah.
The thing, I was absolutely astounded with Trump when he took on McCain.
Yeah,
I think most of us thought that's a bridge too far. That is not going to fly.
Yeah,
and everybody just doubled down on him.
Yeah, but that's the crazy nature. But I think what we'll see is that this cycle matures. We'll see. Yeah, I was never really a good, because it's caucus driven politics, so it's never really a good bellwether for the rest of the country. I suspect that there'll be some fairly strident, Ted Cruz type support out of that part of the country. But as I see the election cycle maturing into New Hampshire, South Carolina, this really the way the Republican Party has established this election cycle. It's really a long-run election cycle. To get to the nomination, to secure the number of votes, you're going to have to be in for the long haul. So the field's going to thin, as it did yesterday, as Bobby Jindal really, I think I saw Jimmy Kimmel last night, and he said...
Did his wife
His wife said, oh, you were running for president. So I think it'll begin to thin out and
I always
clarify.
Tell people, after New Hampshire, you end up with 2.5 candidates.
Yeah, probably.
Two that have a chance and one that is going to have some staying power.
And you may
but
have a
win,
little bit more than that this time. You may, depending on who wins in New Hampshire and South Carolina, you may have a little bit more than that. And then there's Florida. So I think you may have a little bit more than that down the line, but it'll thin out.
If there are still 6 billionaires each willing to write a check to their candidate, then why get out?
Yeah, there you go.
I mean, that's probably the one thing that's different from before. In the past, if you didn't show up at least second or third in New Hampshire, your money dried up. Now you got an audience of one.
Well, now with dark money, undisclosed political contributions, that's true. They can play to a very narrow special interest and stay in the game.
Now back to John McCain. The one thing that keeps on, I think, a lot of us sticks in our craw, did he ever believe this build the dang fence? I mean, that seemed to be posturing to a primary candidate.
Well, yeah. I think the way the spot aired was came off a little tin-eared, but the fact and what he spoke to is part of the plan, and that is we have to secure our border with Mexico. There is no question about that. And, you know, as the Arizona Republic editorial jokingly said yesterday, as the Republicans are running to the pantry on issues of refugees, you know, the logical place to go is, okay, where's our own border? You know, where is our border situation? And so I believe in this cycle that's where this discussion matures eventually, particularly with John in this cycle and talking about border security. And that's a big part of the proposal that Senator Flake and Senator McCain advanced is a significant increase in border security, significant increase in Customs and Border Patrol technology on the border, and
it's not clear that a physical fence is the way to ensure physical security.
I think that's absolute truth.
Electronics,
to that.
Right. Frankly,
intelligence.
A lot of it, I think, employment related thing. People are coming here for jobs,
right? And want to track them, and you want to track who's coming and going.
You can track people who get jobs.
Well, and that, if you read today's New York Times, that was the failure of the Belgian and French security forces to say, here's a guy who had immigrated from Belgium to Syria a multiple number of times, had been involved and had an arrest warrant for him in Belgium, and yet he goes undetected throughout multiple borders. That is not acceptable police work. That's basic shoe leather intelligence gathering and data collection, which we have the authority to do now. And that's what we need to do better.
And in fact, I think that's one of the more intelligent things I've heard proposed on the issue of who comes in. Is that anybody who's been to Iraq or Syria in the last 5 years gets some special attention.
Yeah. Well, Senator Flake came out with that proposal. I think a joint proposal with Senator Feinstein yesterday, which said if you're going to need a visa. You know, it's not the most favored nation status now, which seemed to me to be like falling out of bed common sense.
And to get a visa, you need to go through a process of vetting. And, if you disappeared for 18 months into Syria, you've got some explaining to do.
Well, and there's a video of this guy who committed these atrocities or masterminded these atrocities, participating in jihadist activity in Syria, and yet he comes back. Well, to me, if you're over there and this is just my personal opinion, you're over there, you go there, you participate in that, you come back, you get arrested because those people have declared war on America. Mm-hmm. So you are now, if you're an American citizen, you've just committed treason. Mm-hmm. So I would arrest them. I'd put them in the slammer and say, you're done.
If they're participants.
If they're participants and they are actually doing that and participating in jihadist activity, that's fine. If you want to have political discourse, if you want to have those types of things, but if you're physically participating in that, you're done. You've sacrificed your right as an American citizen.
We'll be back with Chuck Coughlin in the think tank, KTAR 92.3.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we're back in the think tank with Republican political operative Chuck Coughlin. Joe Arpaio, does he have another win in him?
Well, that's a really, really interesting question. That'll be
he's been, like many people, pronounced dead prematurely.
Oh, yeah.
Way too many times.
Many times. So the landscape looks like this. It appears he's guaranteed a civil contempt charge in this federal case.
More or less his own testify.
Yeah, testimony. He's testified that it's civil.
Civil contempt. He clearly stated they violated the federal judge's order. That's civil contempt.
So now the question is, did you willfully, wantonly, knowingly violate it?
Way harder to prove.
But I think they've proved it.
Yeah.
And so I believe in the next coming months that the judge will file a criminal referral on that. Then the question is,
now I'm asking you the political. What is the political implications of a criminal referral?
Well, first, that would require the U.S. Marshal to go book him. So there's going to be a booking photo. That'll be interesting. And then number two, then it's going to be a question of, does the U.S. attorney then file charges? Because it's essentially upped then to the U.S. attorney to file charges.
Know that they have – this would almost be certainly handled by the Tucson office. The chief Tucson litigator is sitting in the courtroom every day.
I'm sure he is. And so the question will be, will they file? So if those things happen, which I believe they will, and the U.S. attorney does file the case, he will be running under that umbrella of a criminal contempt charge, and he will be being prosecuted if the U.S. attorney files on that.
And I'm told that part actually might go much more quickly, so that might actually be completed before the election?
I've never seen the federal wheels move that quickly, but he may want it to go, but he may not from a political perspective, and he may want to play, as Joe often does, the martyr card.
And the martyr card,
I'm just doing my job. I'm protecting the citizens of Maricopa County, and I'm doing my job, and the feds aren't doing their jobs.
And they're just against stealing. They're pro illegal immigration, open borders.
We've all heard that, right? Yep. And so, and that plays well in many areas in Maricopa County, and he's known to have a lot of support. So my thinking is he could conceivably win a Republican primary even under those circumstances. Mm-hmm. So the question is, can a Democrat win? I've really never believed that a Democrat can win even against Joe in Maricopa County. Even under those circumstances, I don't believe that. So then the following question becomes, does somebody file as an independent? Mm-hmm. And keep the Democratic primary field? Is there coordination amongst parties with a law enforcement candidate to run as an independent?
But I think the thing that guarantees his election is if you get a Democrat and an independent, then he's guaranteed.
I think that's
re-election.
True. But if there's a discussion, you need one candidate, you need a one-on-one shot, and I think that's the end of Joe. I really do. It's similar to what happened to Russell Pierce when he had to run in that recall election against Jerry Lewis, where it was a one-on-one shot. It was essentially a general election, not a primary election. And so I believe if those stars aligned and there was a professional law enforcement candidate with a fairly impeccable record to run in that space, that I think you'd have a good shot. Then the question is,
you got to keep a Democrat. Think the enough Republicans would vote for an independent, but could not bring themselves to vote for a Democrat.
Yeah, I do. I think there's Joe again will play the partisan card again and vilify whoever's running against him. I mean, let's be clear.
Thinking of what was that lady's name that ran for Russell Pierce, Cortina?
Cortez.
Cortez. I mean, I'm thinking, does he file a Democrat?
Well, nice. look at it. This last cycle, the superintendent's race. Now, Diane Douglas didn't win Maricopa County. She won every place else, but that was pretty darn competitive here even. Mm-hmm. So, it's an interesting study in it, but we're going to have a lot to talk about over the coming months.
Okay, real quick, who's your pick? Republican ticket? Not preference. I'm saying put on your genius hat and tell me who you think is going to be.
Governor Kasich will either be the vice presidential candidate or the presidential candidate, so he'll be on the ticket someplace because he has an impeccable record as the governor of Ohio, and he's the governor of Ohio. He's a swing state Republican, and so he will be there. So then the question is he in the top of the ticket or is he on the bottom of the ticket, and who's on the top then? So I believe it'll either be Rubio. If he can weather this storm of inexperience, he's a very articulate, attractive candidate, but has some personal challenges in terms of experience. And then does the Bush campaign have a CPR valve? Does somebody start pumping, the chest of George and get that campaign alive again? I do not see how either Carson or the Donald survives the long haul. I don't see Ted Cruz is the most I think fraudulent politician in America right now. Princeton, Harvard, Supreme Court guy, and he's the principal character in this play where he's just this other guy. He's a complete actor on the stage of playing to political audiences rather than actually speaking to problems. And so I don't see how a guy like Ted Cruz can get elected.
It sounds like your assessment is about the same. My assessment was Rubio Kasich.
Yeah.
Florida, Ohio. Wow.
Solid.
Second choice might be Bush Kasich. I can't see Kasich getting the top. He is just not generating any enthusiasm. He's clearly one of the real serious guys on the dais.
Yes, he is. I've said I'm going to support him, and I'm supporting him out here. But that's just with my
We have just a minute. What's your take on the role of terrorism? How does that change the campaign?
I think it changes the presidential campaign in a dramatic fashion because the question will become and is becoming rapidly, what do we do about ISIS? what do we do about the stateless terrorism, and how does America lead again in this world? And so somebody who can come to the forefront, which I think Secretary Clinton will be able to play that message pretty well. Mm-hmm. Who can do that on the Republican side is yet to be seen. But it's going back and hearkening back to Bush 1 and the coalition that we took into to Kuwait to begin this mess. And how do we reestablish that coalition?
It says bring somebody with significant foreign policy chops on either side.
Yes.
So it moves in that direction. I want to leave you with a thought on France and terrorism. It's the summer of 1967. For the first time in human history, between 400 and 700 million people across planet Earth shared a simultaneous experience. Aubrey Singer was a producer with the BBC, and he got the idea to produce an international broadcast with live feeds from around the globe. Four TV satellites had just been put up into space, and for the first time, this is technically feasible. 19 countries contributed. It was broadcast live to 31. The British contribution, and there were contributions from 19 countries, was headlined by the Beatles. Their producer, George Martin, had a historical sense, to realize that starting that song with the Marseillaise, the French national anthem, would be an appropriate way to memorialize the international significance of this event. American technology, British musical genius, and a musical producer with a sense of history.
Nothing you can do, but you can learn how to be you in time. It's easy.